All stations, all stations, all call signs. This is Wrecker Actual, over. Stand by for transmission. Prepare to copy. This is American Vindicta. Well, good afternoon. Welcome. This is American Vindicta. I'm your host, Doug Thornton. And today's episode is episode 46. The date is January 20th, 2022. Yesterday, we had a fun and exciting interview with Steve Quell, and he talked to us about his book, Empire Beneath the Ice, and how the Nazis won World War II. And today, I kind of wanted to expound upon that a little bit, but I'm going to come at it from a different angle. I like conspiracy theories, but I love it when I could back it up with a little bit of military facts and historical facts. So, you know, everything surrounding Antarctica and the Nazis and Operation High Jump, all that stuff, much of it is speculative. Much of it is what the experts would say is classified. But one thing is for certain, Operation High Jump did happen. Members of the world's committees are involved in Antarctica. Antarctica within itself is a sovereign country that no one can own. There are mineral resources in Antarctica that every superpower wants a piece of. There is potentially a hollow earth that leads from one end of the pole from the south to the north. Now, some of that is speculative. Some of it, people will say, is tied up in research, and you can't go there, and it's a military jurisdiction only. There is a no-fly zone over it, for as far as I'm still understanding. But, you know, it's one of those lands that is just, it's wrapped up in mystery. It's one, still probably the last great frontiers that are out there. And it is such a harsh and barren land. Winds can get up to 200 miles per hour. It can be around negative 90 degrees Fahrenheit on average there. But there are parts of it where the water's not frozen. There are parts of it where there are dark brown, rich coal-filled mountains that are sitting on top of a warm geothermal lake, which is also fresh water. So there are still mysteries out there. One thing that's interesting is that if you go to Google Maps through their satellite and you try to look throughout the frozen tundra of Antarctica, you may find some areas where it used to be blacked out, but now it's just large pigmentations of squares that you cannot clearly see whatever it is that they are hiding. And, you know, I mean, conspiracy theorists and the like will come out there and say, you know, the world government, the New World Order, the military, the American government, the elites, they're all hiding things. Now, whether it be the lizard people that David Icke talks about all the time, or, you know, the Hyperboreans that the Nazis were in search for from the Vril Society and the Thule Society, you know, or is it the tall whites, the Aryan race that was wants to be and then come again, that the Nazis also discovered, we're talking about. Whatever it is that's there, it draws in a lot of military and political attention. World leaders almost every year have some sort of a secretive conference that's there. And we don't exactly get to know what they're talking about. Now, you know, it could be something as innocent as just world leaders getting together in a neutral territory to hang out and party with each other like Jeffrey Epstein. But more than likely, there are deals going down that we just will never know about that probably don't benefit us. It benefits the elite, but not us, as per usual with most politicians and politics. So, real quick, we're fixing to go to our first break, but before I go there, I want you to go to my website, www.AmericanVindicta.com, or AmericanVindictaShow.com. This website is going to be continuously updated. We're going to, hopefully within the near future, come across a little bit of a, I guess you could say, a theater, a little bit of theatrics. It'll be something I think that'll be entertaining, something I'm kind of nervous to do, but I kind of want to do anyways, a little bit of acting on my part, but it'll be a cool way to talk about history in the news. Now, there's another part in there that is the sponsors page. If you go to the sponsors page and you click on the link for My Patriot Supply, that will send you to their website. By clicking on that link, that is how I get paid commission. I get 10% of all sales that you make or that you do while clicking on that link, going through My Patriot Supply, and purchasing survival items from them. Between my sponsors and what I make myself, this is how I fund what I do. This is how I fund my research. This is how I fund all the different little devices I have around me at all times that helps all this get thrown together. And this can get quite pricey. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm probably $8,000 in debt just on studio equipment so far. And I got the bare minimum. I was very shocked at how much it is that you really need to make this really nice. And, you know, we're going to continue to go further and further. We got to get some better lights and some cameras, some more microphones. And eventually we'll have it to where we're going to be, you know, actually filming, having guests on, hopefully around a round table and talking about the topics like me and Steve Quayle came on. And, you know, I would like to talk about war. I'd like to talk about politics and history. I'd like to talk about education and technology. But a lot of these things, they take funding. And I'm so sick of hearing people that I listened to for, you know, a decade or more saying, you got to fund me, you got to fund this, you got to fund that. You know, I didn't really believe it until I went down that path and I started doing it. But I'm not asking for you to open up your wallet and start sending me money. If it is something that you'd like to hear, if you feel the Lord pressing to you saying, fund this research, fund what Doug is doing, then by all means, please help me get this going, because I'm only going to continue to get more and more and more deeper into this research, and hopefully it's entertaining. Hopefully I can bring history back to life and, you know, make people interested in it again. But at the same time, if you just like to hear me talk, then the next best thing I can ask you to do is spread the message. We're trying to weaponize history so that we can overcome and overthrow the enemy of tomorrow. We will perish for a lack of not recalling our history and learning from its examples. So one of the best ways that we can fight this is just by spreading this channel. Going to American Vindicta, that is on the gsradio.net. Go to Podcasts on Demand. You can see all of my episodes that are in there so far. You can also go to Podcasts that's on the website, and it'll take you straight to that link. If you like this message, please share it with people. You know, we're still in the baby stages over here. We haven't really learned how to be a toddler and walk yet. But I hope today you're really going to get a kick out of this next episode. So we're going to go to a break, and then we're going to roll straight into it.
The time for political correctness is in the rearview mirror. The fact is, the American dollar is on the verge of collapse. It's been abused mightily by those in power. Massive debt, massive inflation have left Americans with few options. Most think they have no choice but to ride it out with their money in the bank. And sadly, they're going to awaken one day and all that money is going to be gone. Do you have an option? The answer is yes. Precious metals. But knowing to go into precious metals is not the same thing as knowing who to go into precious metals with. We have an answer for you. It's called Renaissance Precious Metals. It's owned and operated by the famed Steve Quayle, radio talk show host, world famous, and an expert in precious metals. Been doing the work for 34 years. So whether you're interested in gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, whatever your interest is, wherever you want to land in your escape pod, this is it. Renaissance Precious Metals can be reached at 406-586-4842. Call Steve Quayle at 406-586-4842. You can also visit them online at sqmetals.com. Ladies and gentlemen, don't wait. The collapse is underway. The time to act is now.
And welcome back. This is American Vindicta. So let's get on to today's topic of episode 46. Nazi UFOs, Operation High Jump, and a little bit of Hollow Earth. Now, these topics are what people would say lie upon the fringe of history and are more linked to conspiracy theory than they are historical fact. But you know what? Occasionally, it's okay to go down that route just to give a little bit more relevance to history, just to bring hopefully a little bit more interest to World War II and, you know, the horrific atrocity that was the Nazi Empire. And, you know, maybe this will help spark a little bit of interest for those who think that this subject's a little lackluster. So let's start with the first topic, Nazi UFOs. Now, in ufology and conspiracy theory and science fiction and comic book stories, we have claims from eyewitness accounts that have circulated linking UFOs to Nazi Germany. The German UFO theories describe successful attempts to develop advanced aircraft or spacecraft prior to and during World War II, and further assert the post-war survival of these craft in secret underground bases in Antarctica, South America, or in the United States, along with their supposed creators. Now, according to these theories and these fictional stories that we hear about occasionally, various potential code names or subclassifications of Nazi UFO craft, such as the Rundflugzeug, I cannot pronounce Deutsch, I'm sorry, the Feuerball, the Discus, the Hanabu, which is one of the probably the most common ones that were used was the Hanabu, the Honeberg Grot, the Glock, the V7, the Vril, Kugelblitz, and Andromeda Garot, Flugkreisel, the Klugelwaff, and then another word that sounds like machine that I'm not even going to try and pronounce. So there's a bunch of different names for these self-propelled anti-aircraft or anti-gravity aircraft. Now, accounts appear as early as 1950 that likely inspired by historical German development of specialized engines such as Victor Schlossberger's Repulsine engine, which was around the time of World War II. Elements of these claims have been widely incorporated into various works of fiction and purportedly non-fictional media, including video games and documentaries, often mixed with more substantiated information. Now, German UFO literature very often conforms largely to documented history on these following points. 1. Nazi Germany claimed the territory of New Swabia in Antarctica and sent an expedition there in 1938 and planned multiple others. 2. Nazi Germany conducted research into advanced propulsion technology, including rocketry and Victor Schlossberger's new Repulsine engine research, a flying wing aircraft that looked like a flying boomerang, and Arthur Sachs' AS-6 experimental circular wing aircraft, the VTOL, VTOL. How about this? 3, some UFO sightings during World War II, particularly those known as Foo Fighters, were thought by the Allies to be prototype enemy aircraft designed to harass Allied aircraft through electromagnetic disruption, which is a technology similar to today's electromagnetic pulse weapons. And one of the strange accounts that is probably the most common thing with most UFOs is that while getting close to a UFO, aircraft will start to experience a disruption within their control boards and their circuitry, and all the electronics will go on and off, and buzzers and bells and sirens will start going on and off. Sometimes the plane or the aircraft will actually lose entire power and begin to then plummet. And then, just miraculously, as the craft would fly off, the plane or whatever aircraft it was would then regain all of its technology, engine and power would come back on, and they'd fly and, you know, typically be safe. And even to this day, these are still reports that we're getting of that same type of description of these anomalies. Now, in World War II, these so-called Foo Fighters, which is a variety of unusual and anomalous aerial phenomena, were witnessed by both the Axis and the Allied personnel. While some Foo Fighters' reports were dismissed as the misperceptions of troops in the heat of combat, others were taken very seriously, and leading scientists such as Luis Alvarez began to investigate them. In at least some cases, Allied intelligence and commanders suspected that Foo Fighters reported in the European theater represented advanced German aircraft or weaponry, particularly given the Germans had already developed such technological innovations as the V-1 and V-2, the A-4 rockets, and the first operational jet-powered ME-262 fighter planes, and that a minority of Foo Fighters seemed to have inflicted damage to Allied aircraft. Similar sentiments regarding German technology resurfaced in 1947 with the first wave of flying saucer reports after Kenneth Arnold's widely reported close encounters with 9 crescent-shaped objects moving at a high velocity. Personnel of Project Sign, S-I-G-N, the first U.S. Air Force UFO investigation group, noted that the advanced flying wing aeronautical designs of the German Horten brothers were similar to UFO reports. In 1959, Captain Edward J. Ruplett, the first head of Project Blue Book, which is Project Sign's follow-up investigation, would carry on quite a few reports about this. And when World War II ended, the Germans had several radical types of aircraft and guided missiles that were under development. We've discussed this previously. The majority were in the most preliminary stages, but they were the only craft that could even approach the performance of objects reported by these UFO observers. While these early speculations and reports were limited primarily to military personnel, the earliest assertion of German flying saucers in the mass media appears to have been in the article which appeared in the Italian newspaper, Giornale d'Italia, in early 1950, written by Professor Giuseppe Belizzo, an Italian scientist and a former Italian minister of national economy under the Mussolini regime. It claimed that types of flying discs were designed and studied in Germany and Italy as early as 1942. He also expressed the opinion that some great power is launching discs to study them. Now, we have something called the Bell UFO, the Nazi Bell. Some people claim this is a hoax from the year 2000, and it was among the first flying objects to be connected with the Nazis. Steve Quill talked about this yesterday on our interview. It apparently had occult markings on it, and it was also rumored to have been very similar to a Wehrmacht document about a vertical takeoff aircraft, of which by that time, the Nazis had several vertical aircraft with a engine placed in the bottom, more or less like a rocket with a pilot in it. It is directly related to the supported and supposed crash of a bell-shaped object that occurred in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania of the U.S. on December 9th of 1965. The same month, German engineer Rudolf Schreiber gave an interview to German news magazine Der Spiegel, in which he claimed that he had designed a craft powered by a circular plane of rotating turbine blades that were about 49 feet in diameter. He said that the project had been developed by him and his team at BMW's Prague Works until April 1945, when he had to flee to Czechoslovakia. His designs for the disc and a model were stolen from his workshop in 1948, and he was convinced that Czechoslovakian agents had built his craft for a foreign power. In a separate interview with Der Spiegel in October 1952, he said that the plans were stolen from a farm he was hiding in near Regen on 14 May 1945. There are other discrepancies between the two interviews that add to this confusion. However, many skeptics have doubted that such a Bell UFO was actually designed or ever built. in 1953 when Avro Canada announced that it was developing the VZ-9AV Avro car, a circular jet aircraft with an estimated speed of 1,500 miles per hour, which is 2,400 kilometers per hour, German engineer George Klein then claimed that such designs had been developed during the Nazi era already. Klein identified two types of supposed German flying disc. One was a non-rotating disc developed at Breslau by V2 rocket engineer Richard Matthey, which was captured by the Soviets while Matthey fled to the United States via France and ended up working for Avro. Hello, Operation Paperclip. The second one was a disc developed by Rudolf Schreiber and Klaus Habermal at the Prague, which consisted of a ring of moving turbines that were blades around a fixed cockpit. Now, Klein claimed that he had witnessed this craft's first manned flight on February 14th of 1945 when it managed to climb up to 12,400 meters, which is about 40,000 feet, in 3 minutes and attained a speed of 1,400 miles per hour in level flight. Aeronautical engineer Roy Fedden remarked that the only craft that could approach the capabilities attributed to flying saucers were those being designed by the Germans towards the end of the war. Roy Fedden, who was also the chief of the technical mission to Germany for Ministry of Aircraft Production, stated in 1945, "I have seen enough of their designs and production plans to realize that if the Germans had managed to prolong the war some months longer, we would have been confronted with a set of entirely new and deadly developments in air warfare." Roy Fedden also added that the Germans were working on a number of very unusual aeronautical projects, though he did not elaborate upon his statement. Now, when you start to talk about all this, you also have to throw in a little bit of occultism, all right? Le Matin des Magiciens, The Morning of Magicians, is a 1960 book that was wrote by Louis Powells and Jacques Berger. It made many spectacular claims about the Vril Society of Berlin. And several years later, many writers, to include Jan van Helsing, Norbert Rothhofer, and Vladimir Terzisky, have built on their work connecting the Vril Society with UFOs. Among their claims, they simply imply that the Vril Society, may have made contact with an alien race and dedicated itself to creating spacecraft to reach the aliens in partnership with the Nazi Thule Society and the Nazi Party. The Vril Society developed a series of flying disc prototypes. With the Nazi defeat, the Society allegedly retreated to a base in Antarctica and vanished into the Hollow Earth to meet up with the leaders of an advanced race inhabiting the Earth. Now, it doesn't matter what I believe in at this point, okay? These are things that have been wrote about in history, and strangely enough, if the aliens and the evacuation to Antarctica kind of makes you question the validity of this, the German scientists, American scientists, Canadian scientists, Italian scientists, and multiple different military accounts of captured German vehicles and blueprints, and then the sightings of unusual aeronautical, incidents, should at least make you say, what are the connections between these unknown aircraft, the supposed Foo Fighters, the UFOs, and this occult society that supposedly funded the bill to have it all made, right? There's at least something there. You know, and unfortunately, I don't really have anything else about that. But it's strange that somewhere in this serpentine of a story, there is a truth here. And within all these major false flags and lies that we hear about, there are still elements of truth there. You know, a lot of this is occultic. A lot of this is fantastical. And you do have experts on there who are on the trail. They're trying to discover as much history as possible, but the Germans destroyed quite a bit of the work. The other part of their work was destroyed by Americans, was destroyed by the Russians, or it was captured. And after it was captured, you didn't hear about it for a very long time. And if you did hear anything about it, it's because it was selectively released to the public just to feed you a little bit of information. But they would never give you the entire inner workings of the nuclear bomb. They would tell you a few things about it, right? That's kind of how I look at a lot of the stuff from World War II. Now, we have another topic about New Schwabenland. So New Schwabenland is a little-known German expedition that went to Antarctica from the 17th of December 1938 to the 12th of April 1939 on the German ship, the MS Schwabenland. And the MS Schwabenland had the purpose of claiming an area which is now known as the Dronningmod Land, mainly to protect the German whaling industry. This area, however, had been previously explored by Norway and was formally claimed by the Norwegians until January 1939, after the Germans had set sail. The Schwabenland, the ship, was equipped with a steam catapult and two Dornier Wall flying boats, which were used to photographically survey 600,000 square kilometers. About a dozen aluminum flags were dropped from the aircraft at turning points of flight polygons, and others were left by foot expeditions. None of these have ever been recovered, though. The land surveyed was claimed by Germany in August 1939 as New Schwabenland, named from the ship. And the outbreak of war prevented two further planned expeditions and the possible building of a base. Though most probably to the other side of the Antarctic, in the Pacific sector, away from the Norwegian claim. And the claim was then abandoned in 1945. On the morning of the 10th of July 1945, the German U-boat U-530 arrived at the Argentine naval base at Mar del Plata near Buenos Aires, 2 months after the German surrender and the end of the war in Europe on the 8th of May 1945. Rumors spread that it had brought Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun and Martin Bormann and others and had landed them on the coast of Patagonia or Antarctica before reaching Mar del Plata. A week later, a Hungarian exile in Argentina, Ladislas Szabo, wrote a detailed account in a local newspaper of how Hitler and his entourage had supposedly escaped Germany. The story quickly spread worldwide, and the versions of it appeared in other newspapers and in many different countries. And on the 17th of August, another U-boat arrived. It was the U-977, also arriving at Mar del Plata, further fueling speculation. The commander of these boats and their crews were arrested and were interrogated by naval personnel from Argentina, the United States, and the UK. They all concluded that the arrivals were innocuous and the crews were released. Yes, the escaping Nazi U-boats were deemed innocuous, with Hitler and Martin Bormann apparently being the guest on them, and then were released. Let that go ahead and fuel a little bit of a conspiracy theory in your head. Now, 2 years later, in 1945, Szabo published a book called Hitler is Alive, where he claimed these two U-boats had taken fleeing senior Nazis to Antarctica as a part of a submarine convoy. The commander of U-977, in particular, Hans Schaefer, denied this, but the rumor still spread. In another version of the story, it is Hitler's ashes that were taken to Antarctica and placed in a special ice cave along with Nazi treasure. Szabo claimed a Nazi Antarctic base called Neubertsgaden had been built in 1938 and 1939. This idea has been taken up by several authors over the years and often building on earlier embellishments, with tales becoming ever more fantastical as time went on. The submarine convoy on the New Berchtesgaden base both first appeared when described by Szabo. There is no reference to either before his publications. Subsequent publications refer to what he initially described, and there has never been any evidence of either. Now, while the Germans were not active in Antarctica during the war, the British were. Great Britain had claimed the sector of Antarctica between 20 degrees west and 80 degrees west to the South Pole in 1908. And Argentina claimed pretty much the same section from the mid-1920s, and so did Chile in 1940, and Argentina and Chile were both friendly with Nazi Germany. From February 1944, Great Britain occupied the region of their claim to rebut the competing claims from Argentina and Chile under the guise of obtaining information about German shipping raiders and U-boats in the region. Several permanently manned bases were established to this end, each with a handful of personnel under Operation Tiberin. Much scientific data was collected during this time and after the war, and work continued as the Falkland Islands Dependency Survey, which later became the British Antarctic Survey. Now we're going to go to a quick break, and then we are going to start to break down Operation High Jump.
Klaus Schwab from the World Economic Forum has said, "You will own nothing and you will love it." And that's represented by what's going on across the planet today, where the economy of the world is in free fall, and nowhere is it more in evidence than with our own President Biden deliberately trying to sabotage what we have, access to food, other resources. So Americans are in a unique position, really for the first time in our history. We're going to have to provide for ourselves or subject ourselves to the whim of the government. Do you really trust a government to feed you that left 1,000 Americans behind enemy lines in Afghanistan? I don't think so. So where do you go? When you ask the question, who's the best prepper out there today? There's only one answer. Ready-Made Resources and Robert Griswold. I call him King Prepper, and that's how a lot of people think of him. You have everything there you'd want, from night vision to storable food, how to prepare cooking in emergency situations, books and videos on how to prepare alternative energy, communication, first aid that you wouldn't think of, natural antibiotics, you name it, Bob has it. Now, here's the good thing about Bob Griswold that no one else does but him. You don't have to buy anything to talk to him. If you're not sure where to start with your preparation, no obligation phone call directly to Bob. You can talk to him for free. Most people will charge you an arm and a leg for a half-hour conversation. That's not Bob Griswold. He cares about helping America get prepared. Go to readymaderesources.com, or you can call the number directly at 800-627-3809. Again, that contact information, readymaderesources.com, for the best prepping outfit in the country, or call Bob Griswold directly, 800-627-3809.
And welcome back. You're listening to American Vindicta. All right, so let's talk about Operation High Jump. Well, before we can explore Operation High Jump, let's explore the, I guess you could say, the people in charge of it and the American-based Antarctic operations that were there. Now, Admiral Richard E. Byrd, who was born on October 25th of 1888 in Winchester, Virginia, was a U.S. naval officer. He was a pioneer aviator, and he was a polar explorer, both the North and South. He was best known for his explorations of Antarctica using airplanes and other modern technical resources. After graduating from the U.S. Naval Academy in 1912, Admiral Byrd was commissioned as an ensign in the U.S. Navy. He learned how to fly at the U.S. Naval Air Station in Pensacola, Florida, and he served in the Navy with distinction until the end of World War I. After the war, he developed navigational methods and equipment for flying boats, and one of which was made the Navy's first transatlantic airplane flight in 1919. He also assisted with dirigibles built for transatlantic crossings, and his polar career began in 1924 when he had a command of small naval aviation detachments with Commander D.B. McMillan's Arctic expedition to western Greenland. Now, Byrd was awarded the U.S. Congressional Medal of Honor for flying across the North Pole and was acclaimed as a national hero. And some doubt always lingered over whether his plane actually reached the North Pole. And one of Byrd's early associates, Burt Balkin, even claimed after Byrd's death that the flight to the North Pole had been a hoax. In 1928, he announced his decision to explore the unknown regions of the Antarctic from the air. With large financial backing from such wealthy Americans as Edsel Ford and John D. Rockefeller Jr., his fame was such that he could inspire the American public to contribute liberally to the estimated cost of the venture, which was about $400,000. Byrd's first Antarctic expedition in 1928 to 1930, the largest and best equipped that had ever set out for the continent, sailed south in October 1928. A substantial and well-supplied base called Little America was built on the face of the Ross Ice Shelf, a wide plain of shelf of ice that is fronting the Ross Sea near an indention in the ice cliff that is named the Bay of Whales. Now, flights were made from this base over the Antarctic continent, and a range of high mountains named the Rockefeller Mountains was discovered, and a tract of hitherto unknown territory beyond them was named the Mary Byrd Land, after Byrd's wife. On November 29, 1929, Byrd, as a navigator and three companions, made the first flight over the South Pole, flying from Little America to the Pole and back in 19 hours with no mishap. Byrd was afterward promoted to Rear Admiral for this achievement. In 1933 to 1935, a second Byrd expedition visited Little America with the aim of mapping and claiming land around the pole. He extended the exploration of the Mary Byrd Land and continued his scientific observations. During the winter of 1934, from March to August, Byrd spent 5 months alone in a hut at a weather station named the Bowling Advance Base, buried beneath the ice shelf, which is 123 miles south of Little America, enduring temperatures between negative 58 degrees and negative 76 degrees Fahrenheit, and sometimes much lower. He was finally rescued in a desperately sick condition, suffering from frostbite and carbon monoxide poisoning, and this was perhaps his most controversial exploit yet. At the request of President Franklin D. Roosevelt, Byrd took command of the U.S. Antarctic Service and led a third expedition to Antarctica in 1939. During World War II, Byrd served on the staff of the Chief of Naval Operations and, among other duties, evaluated Pacific Islands as operational sites. After World War II, Byrd was placed in charge of the U.S. Navy's Operation High Jump. This Antarctic expedition, his fourth one now, was the largest and most ambitious exploration of that continent yet attempted and involved 4,700 sailors, 13 ships, including an aircraft carrier, and 25 airplanes. Operation High Jump ship and land-based aircraft mapped and photographed some 537,000 square miles of Antarctic coastline and interior, much of it never seen before. Byrd flew into Little America from the deck of the aircraft carrier the Philippine Sea, north of the ice pack, about 700 miles from the camp. He made a second flight over the South Pole and took part in several other flights. Now, here's a little more background on Antarctica. By the first half of the 20th century is the colonial period in the history of Antarctica. Between 1908 and 1942, seven nations decreed sovereignty over pie wedge-shaped sectors of the continent. Many nations, including the United States, the Soviet Union, Japan, Sweden, Belgium, and Germany, carried out Antarctic exploration without lodging from formal territorial claims, even though claims may have been announced by some of their exploratory parties. The U.S. government, for example, has never taken up the claims made in 1929 by Richard Byrd's expedition in the Ford Ranges of Mary Byrd Land, an area presently unclaimed, nor those made by Lincoln Ellsworth on aerial landings on November 23, 1935, in Ellsworth Land, an area now claimed by Chile, and on January 11, 1939, in the American Highland near the Amory Ice Shelf, which is east of Antarctica, an area that is now claimed by Australia. The German Antarctic Expedition of 1939 aerially photographed an extensive segment of Princess Astrid and Princess Martha coast of western Queen Maud Land, and dropping metal swastikas over the region claimed it for Nazi Germany. The area is now claimed by Norway. Other claims were transferred, such as that made in 1841 by James Clark Ross, who, after discovering and naming the coastal Ross Sea region after Queen Victoria, claimed it for the British Crown, and the area was later transferred to and is now claimed by New Zealand. Few combative activities have marred the history of Antarctica. World War II brushed the continent only lightly when Nazi commerce raiders used it for nearby seas. The threat of increased activity, however, prompted British warships to keep the northern Antarctic Peninsula under heavy surveillance. Military violence has flared up on two occasions in the region, and in both instances have involved Argentina and the United Kingdom. The first incident took place in 1952 when the Argentine Navy used small arms fire to chase back its ship, which was a British meteorological party that had landed at Hope Bay at the northern end of the Antarctic Peninsula. The matter was resolved when the Argentine government agreed not to interfere with the party. The second, much more serious confrontation took place in 1982 in the Falkland Islands, a British colony that is also claimed by Argentina, called the Islas Malvinas by the Argentines. Argentine forces invaded the Falklands and South George Island in early April. The British responded by sending a military task force reoccupying the islands and forcing the Argentines to surrender. So, why were the Nazis there originally then? Well, here's something that I found from history.com. Now, do your own research with this, but everything that we're going over are just bits and pieces of clues, okay? There are still loopholes out there and plenty of rumors and conspiracies to fill the dark, shadowy areas. Now, Adolf Hitler used the concept of the Lebensraum, the living space, to justify his invasion of Poland and Russia and other Eastern European nations to his people. But one small chapter in Hitler's drive for new land is often overlooked, and that's how the Third Reich's hunger for margarine led to a secret expedition to Antarctica 80 years ago. The tale begins in the summer of 1936. Hitler had completed a four-year plan to boost the German military and the domestic economy to be ready for war by 1940. He put Hermann Göring in charge, and then he developed the German FAT plan to enable Germany to improve the efficiency of its domestic consumption of butter, milk, cream, lard, cheese, bacon, margarine, salad oils, detergents, candles, linoleum, and paints. The idea was to find substitutes for all these oil and fat-based products in case imported sources were cut off. At the time, whale oil was one of the main ingredients for margarine, and Germans ate a lot of margarine. To prepare for war, they needed whale oil, says Cornelia Ludwig, who is a professor of a history of science at Hamburg University. They had to buy whale oil from Norway before, and they didn't want to spend the currency on Norway currently. And they wanted to produce whale oil by themselves. So Germany began building factories for whaling ships to ply the Southern Ocean. At the time, commercial whaling had been decimated in the North Atlantic and North Pacific, and German whaling ships were operating far from home, so the idea of establishing an Antarctic base seemed like a good idea. In 1936, German Foreign Office found some unclaimed territory and sent an expedition to explore and claim the region between 20 degrees east and 10 degrees west, part of an area known as Queen Maud Land. And that's what took shape. So a lot of this really goes into how it was a huge scientific expedition. Well, about after 3 months of repairs to the original ship, New Schwabenland, the captain sailed from Hamburg, Germany in 1938 with a crew of 82 scientists, officers, and enlisted men, as well as two Dornier flying boats perched on catapults. There was one Nazi official on board, which was required by the regime at that time, and he stipulated that everyone had to listen to radio broadcasts of Hitler's speeches around Christmas time. Everyone had to sit in the room, and they had to listen, and there was one speech where there was some atmospheric disturbances, so the radio had to be switched off. The ship reached the Antarctic coastline a month later and began aerial reconnaissance using the flying boats. The mountainous region had never been explored, and the German scientists named it New Schwabenland after their ship. Now, these flights had two purposes: to photograph the area for scientific research and cartography, and also to claim it for Nazi Germany. But things didn't always work out as planned. On one air flight, the crew was running low on fuel and was forced to throw out extra gear to lighten the aircraft weight. That is something, if you really research Admiral Byrd, is actually very common, because when they're flying across the Antarctic, they are on a very limited supply of fuel. And, you know, due to the wind and the freezing weather and the amount of equipment that they're carrying, you wanted to make it back to base more than you wanted to take photographs. So a lot of times they would dump as much stuff possible. And every single flight had all different types of medicines, life-saving supplies, food, stuff to bundle up with in case of a crash. It was typically the first things that were thrown out in order to help preserve any type of a rationing of fuel. And this is what the Nazis had to do. But what they ended up doing also was throwing out a lot of the markers that they were going to use to claim it for Nazi Germany. And like we said before, this wasn't really ever found. But, you know, as per usual, all these things included the boxes of these tiny metal swastikas, and they were thrown everywhere across Antarctica. And, you know, this was something that was supposed to cement the Nazi territorial claim, but those little swastikas, like we said, never recovered. Still, these photographic surveys covered a huge part of Antarctica, and it increased the size of the known area by up to 16%. That's a huge margin. And according to Ludwig's historical research, the surveys covered more territory than the German homeland at the time. The Schwabenland expedition didn't last long. They completed their work and began the long trip home back in February 5th, 1939. On the way home, the ship conducted scans of the seafloor along the Atlantic Ocean. The ship scientists detected seismic activity that they believed was a line of volcanoes running north to south along the middle of the Atlantic. Decades later, this line of volcanoes was found to be the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, a region where two of Earth's tectonic plates are pulling apart and forming new sections of the seafloor. Much of the expedition science was either lost during the war or was kept under wraps until it was finally published in 1958. Although tales of secret Nazi bases or lost Antarctic colonies still populate the internet and make for very good TV fodder, there's no evidence that Hitler had any other further interest in the frozen continent after this expedition returned. Germany would not set up its first permanent station in Antarctica until 1981. So now then, on to high jump. Operation High Jump, 1946 to 47. This Antarctic expedition, which also was Byrd's fourth, is filled with a lot of crazy conspiracy theories. Now, one of the ones that we spoke about yesterday, and, you know, when I say conspiracy theory, I want you to get that out of your mind. I want you to think of more of fable, because in a lot of myths and fables are always some form of truth. And what we know so far is through either documentation of other sailors that were there, documentation of eyewitnesses, Admiral Byrd's diaries that were found many years after his death, and also through various different military claims, was that there was a Nazi base, a Nazi submarine base, that was built out of a cavernous area in Queen Maud Land. And we were sending an expedition of 4,000 men and, you know, 20 various vessels to go and to explore and maybe even attack them. So this is the basis of this story. So let me get back on point real quick, because we're running out of time. So there is a mini documentary from Strange But True Stories, which gives an account of the anomalous details of the U.S. Navy's large-scale 1947 Operation High Jump, led by Rear Admiral Byrd, that conducted scientific experiments and aerial reconnaissance of Antarctica. And during his Arctic flight of 1,700 miles beyond the North Pole, he reported by radio that he saw below him not ice and snow, but land areas consisting of mountains, forests, green vegetables, lakes, and rivers, and the underbrush saw a strange animal resembling a mammoth. Now, the History Channel TV show Ancient Aliens, which is, I think it's on Season 8, Episode 6, has a special segment called the Hollow Earth Hypothesis. Like I said, we get into the weird and wild every now and then with history. Now, this episode discusses accounts of Admiral Byrd's flying into the mouth of a cavern and meeting a race of people called the Hyperboreans that lived under the Arctic shelf. Now, this is also supposedly a place where the Nazis, Adolf Hitler himself, escaped to. Many cultures have had a hollow Earth-like globe featured in their mythology. But modern Earth, or modern hollow Earth beliefs, seem to date back to John Cleve Sims Jr. in the early 19th century. The hollow Earth theory has evolved over time and is now as varied as its devotees, but the universal core belief of hollow Earth theorists is that the Earth is hollow. The crust of the Earth is the outer shell, and embedded in this crust, some miles below, is the center of gravity. And this is also where gravity is reversed. Now, stick with me. This stuff gets weird. Above that line, objects are pulled towards the center of the planet. Below that line, objects are pulled away from the center. Below the planetary wall exists a completely new world, complete with its own continents and even a sun. Inhabiting this allegedly lush and warm world is anything from large, thin, gray aliens, ancient cultures such as the Vikings of Greenland, and Nazis fleeing Allied forces after the Second World War. Some theorists tie this theory to religion, claiming that the mythical Garden of Eden lies beneath us, and that Adam and Eve were actually banished from below to the surface. The lost tribe of Israel is purportedly claimed to be or to have migrated into the subterranean Earth. Now, hollow Earth theorists believe that the polar regions can provide the proof that will convince the rest of the world their theory at each of the poles, which lies entrance into a hollow of the Earth. Some claim that these entrances are gaping holes that extend miles and miles wide, and that caverns exist to lead into the underworld. Now, hollow Earth theorists claim that Proof exists in numerous fantastical accounts of surface dwellers reaching the inside. A common claim is that our own Admiral Byrd flew into a hollow earth on his famous or infamous flight to the North Pole. Another claim, which came up while researching for the early Operation High Jump, portrays the expedition as an American invasion of Antarctica, which failed after encountering heavy resistance from Nazi flying saucers. The other common theory is the Flat Earth, which has a bit more uniformity to it. The Flat Earth Society, extremists among them as they are, I guess you could say, trying to enlighten humanity and convince everybody that the round Earth is actually just a conspiracy. Now, I'm not going to give much breath to these people because I've met a couple of them and they're infuriating to talk to. So we're just going to skip over the Flat Earthers. Sorry to all my Flat Earther believers out there. Well, no matter how you slice it, the rumors, the facts, and other mysteries surrounding the Nazis and the American involvement in Antarctica makes for a fascinating conversation. And from my research, this rabbit hole can lead you very, very deep into historical, mythical, military-based facts, pseudosciences, outlandish claims, you name it. But one thing is for sure, if you go deep enough, you just may go from one pole to another pole. I would say that it makes for a great conversation whenever you're bored. If you really want to do some of this research, Steve Quayle probably has one of the best comprehensive books of all these things piled together. Please visit his website and purchase his book while it's still available. And support what he does, support what we do here at American Vindicta. If you like what we're doing, please go to the website, www.americanvindictashow.com, and you can go ahead now and actually send an email to the show and tell us what you think about it, tell us what you like, or maybe what you'd like to hear next. Ladies and gentlemen, my name's Doug Thornton. You've been listening to American Vindicta. Thank you very much. Out. All stations, all call signs. Prepare for transmission. This is Wrecker Actual. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. End of transmission.